From Cherry Hill Publishing, Wild Woman, A Footnote, The Desert, and My Quest for an Elusive Saint, by Amy Frickholm, read by the author. Preface. Footnote to history. If you have a deep scar, that is a door. If you have an old, old story, that is a door. If you love the sky and the water so much that you almost cannot bear it, that is a door. If you yearn for a deeper life, a full life, a sane life, that is a door. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, Women Who Run with the Wolves. I came to this story looking for a footnote, a fact that seems ironic given what a faint footprint I started following. I was in the Norland Library on the campus of the University of Colorado at Boulder. Outside, the shadow on the sundial near the library door swept along as usual. But inside, there might as well not have been time. I was finishing a manuscript for a book, and I was in the midst of the tedious process of verifying page numbers, publishers, and dates for the footnotes, tracking down books whose ideas I had long since devoured and digested. After working all morning, I found myself at midday, hungry and wandering among the stacks. I suppose I needed a lunch break, but was reluctant to take it with so many footnotes still to go. I cannot account for the flight of the book. Unattractive, dusty, into my hands. I was not looking for it. Having spent my morning with the tiniest of the tiny print, more print should not have been interesting. The book was called Holy Women of Byzantium, 10 Saints' Lives in English Translation. I sat down on the thin carpet, leaned back against other volumes, opened the book at random, directly to the story of Mary of Egypt, of whom I had never heard, and began to read. Always an impatient reader, I skipped the introduction to her story, the background and the context offered by the translator of the 7th century text. I also skipped instinctively the opening paragraph. It is good to keep close the secrets of a king. Who cares? I may or may not have whispered aloud. For me, the story began at a section marked 10. I leafed through the pages as if I knew what I was looking for. While he was chanting psalms and looking up to heaven with an alert eye, he saw the shadowy illusion of a human body appear to the right of where he was standing and performing the prayers at the sixth hour. The rest I read hungrily to the end. I took the book with me to lunch, and while I ate at a deli in the U District, I took out a piece of paper and a pencil and began to eliminate all the words in Maria Cooley's translation that my mind's eye saw as unnecessary. Chanting psalms at the sixth hour, he saw a shadow. A body as if scorched by the sun. Hair sparse and woolly white. He ran weeping until both came to a stream bed that had left its trace. How could a torrent appear in that land? I am no ghost, she said, but altogether earth and ashes and flesh. This exercise was so inherently satisfying, this elimination of words right down to the bones of my fascination, that I repeated the process over and over until the essence of the story had become poetry to me, the beautiful bones of a poem. Then nothing happened. I checked out the book and brought it home. I tried to read about the other women's lives and found myself uninterested. I returned the book to the library and saved my few bones in a file. I applied for jobs as a professor. I went to Ukraine on a Fulbright. I returned to Colorado. Meeting again. Years later, I attended a writing conference. Late one night at a picnic table under a New Mexican moon, I heard the words Saint Mary of Egypt. Not once since I had written the words on my paper until this moment had I heard her name spoken by another person. I moved down to the other end of the table to listen. The speaker was a young woman who had recently converted to Orthodox Christianity and had chosen Mary of Egypt as her patron saint. Listening to the woman talk, I felt conflicting feelings about Mary of Egypt rise to the surface. On the one hand, I suddenly recognized that I had long wanted to go out and join her in the desert. My own desire for solitude and silence could sometimes become the unrestrained fervor that Mary spoke of so often. I wanted that kind of wild freedom, to be completely hidden and alive in the heart of the desert. On the other hand, I also wanted to invite her home. If shame kept Mary out there, I wanted to wrap her thin, bare shoulders in a blanket, feed her more than a few fingered lentils, and release her from every shred of self-hatred that might keep her alone in the desert. The image of Mary of Egypt, that night and many days and nights since, leads me again and again to ask what I seek in the desert and what I want to bring home, reconciled and healed, but wild. Mary's story, sensual and ascetic, holy and unholy, connected to God but unconnected to all others, illiterate but deeply learned, seemed to unearth my most basic longings, the ones that are etched so deeply into my life that for 15 years I have traced and retraced them with the same paradox of knowing and not knowing that drew me to that book on the shelf in the first place. I'm reminded of some lines from a poem found in the Nag Hammadi papers from the first century. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the barren one, and many are her sons. I am she whose wedding is great, and I have not taken a husband. Why, you who hate me, do you love me, and hate those who love me? You who deny me, confess me, and you who confess me, deny me. You who tell the truth about me, lie about me, and you who have lied about me, tell the truth about me. I began to make plans to explore the life of this Mary of the desert. I knew that exploration included the wild places of my own heart. I wanted to ask what this Holy One knows, in hopes that it would open new doorways and might lead to my own transformation in the desert wilderness, in my own complex interior. My old life. But that was not all. By the time I went to follow Mary into the desert, the life I'd lived for 18 years was ending in ways that were outside of my control and far, far outside of my desires. The announcement of my old life's end came swiftly on a Wednesday morning in late August 2018, a few days before I was to leave for Cairo to begin my trek in the footsteps of Mary of Egypt. I had agreed to pick up Allie, one of my closest friends, who also happened to be my priest, at 5:30 a.m. and drive her over a mountain pass for a routine colonoscopy. The morning was bright and clear. I had not gotten up in time to finish my coffee, so I poured it into a travel mug and hoped the smell of it would not make her nauseous after she had been fasting all night. Every week for nearly two decades, with few breaks, Allie and I had cooked and served a free community meal for 50 or more guests at St. George Episcopal Mission in Leadville, Colorado, sharing every aspect of that work. Our life together was mundane, made up of long walks, shared books, child raising, and how long to leave a turkey in the roaster at the church, and poems. We spent the better part of these decades immersed in poems and ancient stories, as though we had unknowingly agreed to a long apprenticeship. In her sermons, Allie would often take a biblical text and point out how she had been arguing with it until its light had dawned on her and she had seen what was lying below the surface. She would follow this moment of grace with a poem by Rumi or Hafez or Mary Oliver or Naomi Shihab Nye, her frequent favorites. I would leave those sessions savoring new language and new ideas and old stories as if they were flavors I had not fully tasted before. That day I dropped her off at a hospital, but since parking on the narrow street in Vail was complicated, I drove on to a coffee shop to wait for her call. Later than I expected, my phone rang. "Can you come?" she asked. Her voice sounded thin and shaky, like it had become sand. But what kind of bad news was even possible? I asked myself as I drove out of the parking structure. This was a routine colonoscopy. At the hospital, the doctor said that Allie had a mass in her colon. "It's cancer," he said. Even though he was waiting the official results of the biopsy, he nonetheless recommended she plan for surgery the following week. The most significant crisis that Allie and I had ever faced came in an awkward moment. I was hours away from leaving on this trip that by now had been 15 years in the making and 2 years in the planning. I would be away on a treasure hunt, that's how I thought of it, in search of an ancient wild woman. I intended to put my feet down in every place that was mentioned in the text that recorded her life. "Maybe I should postpone," I said to Allie, "until your surgery is over." "No way," she said. "I can't explain it, but I feel you are going for both of us." Crossing the River. Mary of Egypt was born along the Nile River in Egypt. As a young girl, she ran away from home. Maybe this occurred in the 3rd century, maybe the 5th. No one knows, and there are no records. She ran to Alexandria, where she took up a life of spinning, begging, and most importantly, sex. She liked sex so much that she didn't even charge money for it, according to the document, even though she could have used the money. One day, when she was 29 years old, she saw a boat of pilgrims headed for Jerusalem for the Feast of the Holy Cross. When she asked if she could join them, they asked if she had any money. When she said no, she offered her body to them in exchange for passage. The pilgrims took the deal. She arrived in Jerusalem several days later, still having sex with as many people as she could. She followed the pilgrims to the courtyard of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the traditional site of Jesus' burial. In the courtyard, she tried to go into the church with the other pilgrims, but as she approached the door, she was mystically rejected. Every time she tried to enter, she was pushed back until she was left in the courtyard alone. There, she had an encounter with an icon of the Virgin Mary. In her encounter, she recognized that her spiritual condition prevented her from entering. She pledged to the icon of Mary that if she would be allowed to enter and see the true cross, she would change her life. Whatever had been barring the door was lifted, and she was able to enter the church. When she returned to the courtyard, she asked the Virgin Mary what she should do next. From afar, she heard a voice that said, "Cross the Jordan, and you will find a beautiful rest." She took these words as instructions. She asked directions to the Jordan and was given 3 coins with which she bought 3 loaves of bread. She crossed over the river and lived for many years in the wilderness. In that wilderness, in the wild, she found freedom. One day, the story says, 47 years later, a monk named Zosimus was crossing the desert. He was on his own spiritual quest, trying to free himself from the burden of extreme self-satisfaction. He saw Mary and thought she was a spiritual guru, one of the holy men of the desert, so he chased after her. When he found her and discovered she was a woman, he begged her to tell him her story. She did. Then she asked Zosimus to come again in a year and bring her communion. They met on the bank of the Jordan. Then she asked him to find her again in the wilderness in a year. The next year, when he went to find her, she was dead. A lion licked the soles of her feet. Zosimus buried her in the desert with the lion's help. This story had rung in me. I had recognized the ringing, but I didn't know what it meant. On the surface of things, I didn't have anything in common with this woman. I wasn't a prostitute, a runaway, or an abused child. And while I had some hermit-like tendencies, I wasn't a desert hermit either. Many Orthodox people I knew had an affinity for Mary of Egypt, but Orthodoxy had never drawn me in. Thanks to Allie, I was a reluctant Episcopalian with some Taoist inclinations. Still, this had my name on it and would not let me go. After encountering Mary of Egypt that second time, my sketched-out notes from that day in the library were no longer enough. I began to research Mary's story in earnest. First, I turned to the scholarly texts. What did the scholars say about Mary of Egypt? How was she treated in the literature? But no matter how many books accumulated on my bibliography, reading wasn't what the story asked of me. Maybe, I thought, I haven't gotten close enough to the story itself. Maybe the translation was getting in my way. One day at my desk at work in Chicago, I picked up the phone and called the library at DePaul University. "If I wanted," I said to the librarian, stumbling to articulate what I was searching for, "I mean, how would I find..." I was embarrassed not to have even the most basic knowledge of how to get a copy of the Greek text. But the librarian, with infinite patience, listened and pointed me to the Petrologia Graeca, a collection of writings from ancient Christians that included Bios Mariae Aegypti. He sent me a photocopy in the mail. Holding the text in my hands was progress, but I didn't actually know how to read it. I stared at the squiggles on the page and rued the day that I had walked into Greek 1 at St. Olaf College and immediately walked out again. "Well," I said to myself, "you have to start somewhere." I called my dad, who was a Greek scholar. "Dad, could you teach me Greek on Skype?" We began. After 2 years of alphabet, conjugations, and declensions, I could pick my way through a text. We turned to Mary. With a Bowers lexicon, we started piecing together a translation of the life of Mary of Egypt as told to St. Sophronius. It was slow, messy work. Many lines of the text demanded not just an understanding of the words, but an interpretation of Mary herself that despite all my studying, I didn't feel prepared to give. For example, the text briefly describes the moment when Mary departs Upper Egypt for her life of prostitution in Alexandria. But the word that describes her leaving is ambiguous. It could mean that she set aside her affection for her family. This would suggest that despite her love for them, she faced something so traumatic that she ran. Or it could mean that she rejected their love for her, thus making her seem like a heartless adolescent who left despite having a loving family that did not want her to go. Some of the questions also required us to make ethnic and even racial determinations that, again, I felt ill-equipped for. When the monk Zosimus describes seeing Mary for the first time, either he sees someone who has dark skin, as if they had been burnt by the sun, or he sees someone who, after a long time in the desert, has a skin color changed by the sun. One of these indicates an African saint. The other is more in the European and iconographic tradition of Mary that we have inherited. This might not have mattered a lot to the first readers of this text, but for me, it had implications I needed to acknowledge and explore. When at last we had a translation, I did not feel like the itch was scratched. Translation had not given me a stronger understanding of Mary. It had provided a stronger understanding of the person to whom the writing of the story is attributed, a desert-dwelling patriarch named Sophronius. Translating this text, I didn't become Sophronius' biggest fan. He exaggerated Mary's lust at every turn for his own amusement. He lacked sensitivity to the realities a 12-year-old girl might have faced in her society. He was far more obsessed with the parts of the story I cared nothing about, dedicating chapters and chapters to Zosimus's education and decision-making, as well as metaphors and references that did not feel relevant to my quest. Sophronius's take on Mary of Egypt actually seemed to lead away from her and not toward her. She, the woman who had run away from Zosimus while he pursued her to the point of tears, was as elusive as ever. "Well," I thought, "that's because she's a legend, not an actual person. She can't speak through the text because she's made of the text, not herself a maker. She's a myth." Nonetheless, I continued to accumulate files and footnotes. I tried occupying the mind of the only two characters in the myth, Mary and Zosimus the monk. I read books about Jungian mythic structure and Christian myth-making. I accumulated dead ends. Here's the question I put to myself over and over again. Why? Why was I immersing myself in the life of Mary of Egypt? What was she offering me that I needed? Maybe my inability to answer this question was a character defect. Years before, when I'd written my dissertation, my advisor would ask, "How are you going to answer the so what question?" At home, I screamed into my pillow about the so what question. Later, when I was a journalist, a mentor asked me point blank, "So what?" when I proposed story ideas. Whenever she asked, I felt like a balloon leaking air. Then she would say, "It's a battle for the soul of America." "Right," I would say. But later, in my room alone, I would stare at the saggy little balloon of an idea and wonder how it could be a battle for the soul of America. So what? I asked myself a million times. As I studied Mary's context, the streets of Alexandria, the ports, Jerusalem, the vast Jordanian wilderness where she spent most of her life, I felt her recede ever more into the distance. She ran away from me as she ran away from the monk Zosimus, as if I stood on the edge of the same wadi calling out, "Stop and give me your blessing." She did not turn around. I felt out of options, but even with her elusiveness, I'd never encountered a saint more relevant to my own moment than this strange woman of the desert, rebel and repentant, lover and sinner, a hungry exile in search of freedom and rest. Her desire reverberated through the centuries as if she'd spoken yesterday. Even though Mary had first come to me through a book on a library shelf, what she asked of me was not found in books. Where might it be found? Bewilderment. A question is a key, says Jungian psychologist and folklorist Clarissa Pinkola Estes. A question doesn't actually want an answer. It wants a door into the psyche. In order to find this door, I could no longer treat Mary as a myth or as a text. She had to become a person, and the life that I had so painstakingly translated had to become a map to find her. The key words became as if. As if Mary of Egypt had walked here. As if she had lived. As if she were a real human being. The idea was exciting to me. Since I could not come closer to Mary in time, I would close the gap with space. I took the manuscript and mapped it out. Here are the places I needed to go. Here is the landscape I needed to walk. Even while the idea grew on me, I recognized that it cut against my training as both an academic and a journalist. In neither of those disciplines is as if a legitimate category for exploration. As if was not solid ground. As if was like saying, I have chosen naivete over reason, myth over history. And yet I planned to take everything I had learned as a scholar and a journalist and apply it to my quest. I wasn't abandoning my trades, but I was using them in service of something further outside the realm of the ordinary. Literary critic David Jasper makes clear his opinion that Mary of Egypt cannot be followed. Mary of Egypt's silent life, he writes, in the sacred desert, teaches little or nothing. But in the act of reading, it provokes puzzlement and a demand to be taken seriously. It has a harshness which claims no validity by any external standard, and no possibility of reenactment. Hers is not a life actually to be lived, but it makes its excessive demands in ways that are socially disruptive and destabilizing. So I interpreted this as, read about Mary all you want and let her mystery work on you, but don't go out there looking for her. She will not be found. I became a pilgrim to the impossible anyway. The call of as if was stronger than the disciplining voices in my head. Of the archetypal wild woman, Estes writes, in our bones we know her. We yearn toward her. We know she belongs to us and we to her. Go into the wild with Mary of Egypt, I thought. Mary had lived her life by seeking larger and larger landscapes until there was nothing larger to be sought than eternity. I would seek the bigger sky to which she was called. Like Peter Matthiessen tracking after a snow leopard, I would track toward Mary as toward an earthy but semi-mystical being. I intended to pass through another world in an attempt to meet her, even if I did not have an answer to the so what question. Bewilderment, says the poet Fanny Howe, is a way of entering the day properly oriented. For her, bewilderment is a poetics, an ethics, and a theology all rolled into one. An Islamic prayer underscores this point. God, increase my bewilderment. As I considered my state of bewilderment and the bewilderment into which my trip would take me, I found myself breaking this word into bits. Be wilder meant. It felt like a directive. Be wild. Be wilder. In the mythic world of Mary's story, No one ever makes spiritual progress by staying at home and thinking. To become a pilgrim is to take an inward journey by walking through actual time and space. One seeks the unknown world through both an inscape and a landscape. In other words, I had to go to the desert. On long walks with Allie, I laid out this idea of walking Mary of Egypt's story as if, about turning a dream into a landscape and a landscape into a dream. Perhaps it was the long tutelage in scripture and poetry, but we both, without hesitation, felt a yes. Unknown Egypt. I knew that I didn't want to show up in Egypt without a plan, but I also didn't want to sign up for a traditional tour, led along to look at mummies and pyramids, all the time wondering how to find Mary of Egypt. I didn't know where to begin. I did not speak Arabic, and I had never been to any of the countries where Mary of Egypt lived. Despite my obsession with the saint herself, I had never been fascinated by this part of the world. It wasn't on my own personal bucket list. I'd never been drawn to pharaohs or sphinxes. I had no desire to see biblical sites or tombs. All I had was a scrap of a story, and that didn't seem like enough to build an itinerary. But other things were falling in line. My grandmother left me a small inheritance. I checked in with Allie to see if she thought I could leave the community meal for a couple of months while I traveled, and asked her if September and October would be okay. Since this was before the diagnosis, she said, sure, sounds like fun. I asked my boss for some time as well, and he also agreed. Still, I didn't book tickets or find housing. I found myself paralyzed as I searched for some connection in Egypt that would be a signal to me that it was time to go. One day, I wrote to Yehia Eldekin, a member of a small company called Holiday Tours. For some reason, on this particular day, at this particular hour, sitting in a hotel room in Chicago, I poured out my uncertainty. Dear Mr. Eldekin, I'm planning a trip to Egypt to research a late ancient Egyptian woman who is called, in the Christian tradition, Mary of Egypt. One strange part of this journey is that she may or may not have actually existed, but I'm going to act as if she did and try to follow in her footsteps, recognizing that this is kind of a postmodern quest. The story goes that she was born and raised in rural Egypt. We don't know where precisely, and that is something I could use some help thinking about. When she was 12 years old, she ran away from home and went to live in Alexandria. This is approximately the 5th century CE. Some traditions say 6th, some say 4th. In Alexandria, she lived as a prostitute, beggar, and a spinner of flax. When she was 29, she left Alexandria on a boat full of Libyan pilgrims who were headed to Jerusalem for the Feast of the Holy Cross. She basically sold sex to the pilgrims in exchange for passage. From there, she had a mystical experience and ended up in the desert as a hermit. In my mind, the Egyptian portion of my journey would involve the following. 1. Some exploration of Alexandria, especially an understanding of its late ancient aspects. I am interested in how prostitutes lived. For example, I have read that the poorest lived in doorways, but in my American mind, I can't actually figure out what this means. I have never been to this part of the world, so I'm hoping for a more physical sense of all of this, not just things I'm making up in my head. 2. I would like to travel along the Nile River to explore the Egyptian countryside. I would like to understand more about this way of life and the ecology of Egypt. Again, I have no idea what remnants of this time period are available to experience, but even to have a sense of the river itself seems important to me. 3. I have been also reading a lot about the Christian desert monasteries, and so I think I would like to have a more visceral experience of them. 4. And of course, I'm interested in contemporary Egypt, people, and food. I have heard that I should try to bring my husband or son with me in order to have male companionship. Is this necessary? I can bring one or both of them along, but this search is definitely mine, not theirs. They would come along to be nice. But if I need them, I need them, and I am sure we would have a good time. If you think that wise, I can work on this. I am eager for your advice and would be grateful for whatever you can do. I recognize that this could be an odd challenge to take on, so if it is not right for you to help me, please feel free to pass this on to someone else. All the best, Amy. Not 2 days later, an email arrived. Dear Amy, good day to you from Cairo. I received your email on Tuesday while driving, and my wife read it out loud. I have to tell you that we both really enjoyed reading about Mary being a real person, or maybe not, and we are interested to know about your findings and help your story. The research is very specific. I like specific requests of people visiting my country because it's clear that they are appreciating our history and culture. I believe I can help you. And no, you do not need male companions to travel in Egypt, but you might consider bringing some family. Egyptians are family people, and they will understand you better if you have your family with you. I have to tell you, Amy, that your writing style is very nice. Best regards, Yehia Eldekin.